When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Formula One tends to go in cycles. They've had this amazing run of success. Now some people are leaving. They've got a little bit of destabilization, less consistency, a little bit of turmoil, and it can often lead you down a path where you stop humming along and things start to deteriorate inside, and you have to go through another sort of period of rebuilding like McLaren did in the background.
Hello and welcome to the James Allen on F1 podcast brought to you by Autosport. This week we're doing something a little bit different. It's the season so far in numbers. Amazingly, we've already had a quarter of this F1 season, six rounds to analyse and to comb through for narratives, patterns and trends. And who better to help us with this task than BBC Five Live broadcaster, podcaster and former McLaren mechanic Mark Priestley. How are you doing, Mark? Very good, very good. And Autosport's resident expert on all things complicated that need explaining simply, Jake Boxall-Legg.
Thanks for having me, James. Although there have been some complicated transpirings this morning that I don't think I can necessarily explain. So we'll see how this goes.
Okay, and later on, we're going to be joined by F1 data guru and top engineer, formerly with Ferrari and Williams, Rob Smedley. But let's start with a few headline numbers from this quarter season so far. Oscar Piastri, 4 wins, 1 podium, 2 pole positions. Max Verstappen, 1 win, 2 podiums, 3 pole positions. Lando Norris, 1 win, 1 sprint win, 4 podiums, 1 pole. Mark, is this a bit more one-sided in McLaren's favour than you expected when this season kicked off? What are your former McLaren buds telling you about how they're feeling about things? And how has Piastri got 4 wins to Norris and Verstappen's 1 each?
So first of all, everyone inside McLaren are very happy right now because they are in a very, very strong position. There's no doubt about that. I think, is it as dominant as I thought it was going to be? I'm not sure. They are very dominant. You know, make no mistake, they have the best car on the grid in almost all conditions, it seems. But I think the one thing that is going to keep this season interesting, at least so it looks early on, is that the actual gaps of performance are swinging. They're ebbing and flowing a little bit between different tracks, different environments, so temperatures particularly, different tyre configurations. So although McLaren, if you just look at the numbers, McLaren have been utterly dominant, you know, that the stats do stack up very much in their favour. If you actually go in and look at some of the gaps, it's not been as clear-cut as certainly it seemed in Miami, where they won the race by well over 30 seconds. So I think there's going to be interest as the season goes on because it's not all going to go in McLaren's favour. And look, there's always a development race in Formula One. This year, that might be sort of curtailed a little bit because of the sort of massive changes coming in 26, where people have to switch their focus, and many of them will have done that to some large extent already. So maybe the development race in 25 will be less aggressive than we've been used to in recent years, but there is still opportunity for teams to improve and close that gap. The opportunity that McLaren have to extend their gap, if you like, is probably smaller just because the sort of laws of diminishing returns. They already have a very good car. The others around them have an opportunity to close that gap, seeing what they're doing, seeing what they're capable of. There's more performance to come from others if they're in a position to be able to take advantage of it.
Jake, you know, we're a quarter of a second of the season in, but how many horses do you think are in this world championship race?
I mean, I think in terms of drivers, you'd certainly obviously have both McLarens in that. I don't think you can discount Max because he's been there when, if McLaren has dropped the ball, we have seen in qualifying, and McLaren does seem to corroborate this, that it is very difficult to get that ultimate last bit of performance out of the car. So you sort of see the drivers kind of overdoing it a little bit because the car seems to favour just like a little bit of patience when you're entering corners. And this seems to be at odds with the driver kind of motto of attack the corners and sort of catch it on the exit. This car seems to be patient in, and then you can just gun the throttle pretty early into the corner. So it sort of seems to be throwing them a little bit all over the place. And Red Bull seems to be able to pick up the pieces in qualifying and on their day, as we saw in Suzuka, as we saw to a degree in Jeddah as well. It is still quick in the hands of Max Verstappen. And I'm going to enter a fourth member in here, and it does depend on his team's rate of progress over the season. It depends how much development work that Mercedes does, and that is George Russell. I do have the current table of super times available in front of me, and that being basically a function of how far the driver is off on average of the theoretical fastest time set on a weekend. And this is all averaged out over the weekend. So currently this is led by Piastri on 0.05%. And then Norris is a further 0.5% behind him. Sorry, 0.05% after him. Verstappen's also very, very close. And Russell, 0.283% off the theoretical fastest. So he's in this ballpark. And he's been leading the way for Mercedes all season. So I'm going to put those four forward.
Yeah, that's very interesting. We'll get into the kind of underlying car pace and compare things. I mean, let's dive into the numbers a little bit more deeply. When it comes then to who's got the fastest car, it's clearly McLaren. And as you were saying, Mark, that seems to be the case across whether it's a street circuit, a fast-flowing, a hot circuit, a cooler circuit. It doesn't seem to make any difference. In terms of the underlying pace of the car, so not the actual lap time that was achieved in qualifying necessarily, but there's ways of measuring the actual underlying speed of the car. The gaps are actually quite interesting. Red Bull has been as little as 9/100ths off in Saudi, for example, but as much as 0.4 of a second off in Bahrain. And yet Verstappen has got three poles. And that says to me, Mark, that he's outperforming the car.
Yeah, I think that's right. And you know, also, if you look at, I think you mentioned earlier on, Lando with just one race win, that seems crazy to me if you think about the dominance that McLaren's had. How's he only got one race win from a quarter of the season? He's going to be clearly disappointed with that. But the fact that Max has taken a race win and got that level of performance, as Jake said, you can never rule him out. He's getting the best out of his car. And, you know, I've got a theory about this whole driver performance and particularly some of the second driver challenges that some of the teams are having, notably Red Bull, getting somebody to match their lead driver. You could argue a little bit at McLaren with Norris as well. I think we've got to the end of this stable set of regulations that we're in right now. And everyone's kind of figuring out how to get the best out of these cars. And actually, if you go back sort of, I don't know, 10 or 15 years, I feel like the level of the top teams' cars was some way away from what you could imagine the theoretical maximum performance would be. So what I mean by that is you could put a various number of different inputs into the car from driving style and get a similar lap time. You could put a various different inputs in terms of car design, for example. So look up and down the pit lane, cars looked quite different at times, and yet lap times are always quite similar. I feel like now we're so much closer to the theoretical performance limit. These cars have really specific nuances about what they need putting into them from both of those elements I mentioned to get the best out of them. At Red Bull, Max clearly does that. His driving style, his natural characteristics of the way he drives a car almost perfectly sync up to the way that Red Bull's been designed. And actually, most of the other drivers that have tried that second seat haven't managed to do that. You can look at Lewis Hamilton, you know, one of the world's greatest drivers in history. We go to this sort of ground effect era of Formula One, and his driving style just doesn't seem to quite deliver what's required. And you can say the best drivers should be able to adapt to any type of car. And I believe there's some truth in that, but I feel like we're so close to the limit now, and therefore the differences are so small that we're looking for. If you ask a driver to compromise and deliver those real specific inputs, you're also asking them to compromise what they're able to bring. And I think that's a big challenge up and down the grid now. So when you talk about numbers and you talk about differences being so small, which they are, and the data really does point to this, I think you can also look at the fact that this era that we're in and this state of the regulations, and it may all change again next year, of course, but we're so close to the limit. You're looking almost, when it comes to driver selection, you should be looking for the driver that matches your car rather than just what we think is the best driver according to the numbers on the grid.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Mark. And then the other factor is that you've got to be in it to win it, as they famously say. You know, I mean, and that's all about consistency. So another number I really like from the first part of the season is that Piastri has completed every single racing lap since Brazil 2023. So keeping the car on the circuit and being competitive, race in and race out, is why, a big part in my mind of why Piastri is where he is. So Miami was Piastri's 32nd consecutive point scoring race weekend. And that's the fourth longest streak in the history of Formula One, behind only Hamilton, who did it once with 48, Verstappen, who once did 43, and Hamilton again did 33. So it says a lot about what you were saying earlier about Hamilton's sort of status in the sport, notwithstanding his recent struggles. But I think, you know, if you're talking about just 24-year-old kid in his third season in Formula One, Jake, those numbers, I think, are very, very telling.
It's super impressive, isn't it? And I think when Piastri came into Formula One and he was in his first season with McLaren, I think there were sort of clear and legitimate, not complaints as such, but points where he needed to improve. And it was just basically par for the course for a rookie, needs to get the best out of the car in qualifying, needs to get a little bit more out of his time management, because at the time, Lando had a sort of pretty healthy advantage in getting more out of the car per lap during a race than Piastri could, and for longer. And I think that prevailed continued into 2024. But this season, it just seems to be a complete reversal of that. Piastri just seems to be on top of keeping that race pace up through a long stint. And obviously it's helped by the McLaren being very, very easy with its tyres, keeps them cool, doesn't overwork them, which is really, really good when you get to some of the hotter venues. At Suzuka, it wasn't so much of an advantage, but especially in the last three races. And obviously you've seen Piastri win them all. And he's just able to get something else out during a qualifying lap. It's not, okay, it's not 100% repeatable. And as we sort of already discussed, the McLaren, it does make it very, very difficult to, you know, or one lap or every lap rather, give the driver the confidence to put that lap in. But he's just better than he was now. He's in season three. He just seems to be improving all of the time. And he just has this effortless coolness about him. He just doesn't seem to be bothered or fazed by anything. You know, I guess you can trust that to Lando, who is sort of quite open with his emotions, and he accepts the car, as Mark has kind of already said. Maybe Lando feels that the car doesn't suit him as much as it does Oscar. That being said, Piastri's just been on, I think, emotionally and performance-wise, just on a different level this season so far. It's now up to Norris to put a pin in the first sort of, which has still been quite good, by the way, put a pin in the first six races and say, okay, we're close, let's move on the game.
Isn't it interesting, James, sorry, just to jump in, that idea of looking at these numbers, and I'm sure Rob will say this later on, whenever we're looking at data in Formula One, there's always this idea you have to sort of just temper it with a bit of common sense or a bit of human input, because you can get lost in the numbers. And if you just look at that number you said there about Oscar having this unbelievable 32 race streak of scoring points finishes, and if you look at the other two drivers that are in that same ballpark, Hamilton and Verstappen, it also looks, you know, if you look at those numbers, it shows you that clearly that's much easier to do when you're at the front. And they're both drivers from the modern era as well. So there are 24 races in a season right now, of course, which you know, they're coming at you thick and fast. But when you're at the front of the grid It's obviously much easier to finish the race because A, you're not stuck in traffic. You've got hopefully a clear track in front of you. You can deliver the performance. You're not hampered by the dirty air that we see so often now. So the other way to look at these numbers, and I think always important when you're looking at numbers, is to just look at what else lies behind the numbers as opposed to just taking them all on face value. And it's the same with points tallies, record point scoring. You know, in the modern era, of course, it's a very different story to the one when only the top eight used to finish and get points back in the day. So it's the numbers are always fascinating, but I think it's always about looking deeper into what they might mean and what might lie behind them is an important factor too.
Well, that's exactly where I was coming on to, actually, because behind the numbers are the human beings. And what we're seeing here, I think, with McLaren is a team that is clearly humming internally. They're not fighting against each other. Maybe there's the odd little moment of friction between the drivers. You're inevitably going to get that when you're in a championship fight. But the team as a whole is harmonious. They're all heading in the same direction. They're well-funded. They've got a very good technical setup. And you can just tell that you've been in this experience, this yourself, Mark. You've been at McLaren when they were humming along and winning. And once a team kind of gets that flow, it's quite difficult to stop it. I mean, you look at the Mercedes team that dominated for many years. You look at Schumacher's Ferrari period. Contrast that with Red Bull. Obviously, last year was quite a turbulent year for various reasons. Again, many human factors there. Departures, very high-profile departures. And even now, you know, I was picking up on Jungle Drums out in Miami when I was there last weekend, that there's some dissatisfaction. Again, another kind of niggly, unnecessary pit stop error during the sprint race that compromised Verstappen. You know, these are all things that speak of a team that's not humming along. Red Bull. So Verstappen, again, not only is he outperforming the car, but he's also outperforming his situation, which I think is very, very interesting. And it'd be very interesting to see how long he can sustain that for across a challenging season. Interesting that you throw into the mix a massive life event like becoming a father for the first time, which normally would calm someone down a little bit internally and make them see. It's like going through the back of a wardrobe into a new world. You see a completely different world when you become a father for the first time. And I've no doubt that there will be elements of that. But so Max's human situation, I think, is very, very interesting. But just bringing it back to the numbers again, and back to you again here, Mark, because Miami 2024 was only McLaren's second race victory in 11 years. But since Miami last year, they've won 11 races. And that, I think, tells you everything you need to know about a team that is humming along.
Well, yeah, it absolutely does. And humming along is a really nice way to describe it because it really is, like you said, it's every person, it's every department, it's the whole thing is just working. But what that might look like from those numbers, and again, to go back and dig slightly deeper, a lot of fans will say, well, from Miami in 2024, that's when McLaren found something, they turned it around and their fortunes changed. Whereas I would say, I mean, I know this because, you know, I know a lot of people, a lot of good friends still in the team, that result that started in Miami and has gone on to deliver those following 11 wins, that didn't start in Miami. It started about 10 years prior to that when they were in the doldrums of really struggling and it certainly wasn't humming along and in a little bit in the way that you talk about Red Bull, just maybe seeing the start of this turnaround now in a negative sense, McLaren were all over the place. Internally, chaos, people moving around and leaving, management structures changing. There was so much chaos internally that we didn't always see on the outside, but it just stops you humming along, like you're saying. So around about 10 years ago, or whenever it was, they began to put this stability in place, build the team from the inside out. Much of it's long, you know, way behind closed doors that we don't see. And then fans of the sport only see the final result, which was that big turnaround, or so it seemed, in Miami. And that was after an 11-year drought, like you say. So it sort of looked like they struggled for 11 years and then found something amazing and it turned things around and now look at them. But the truth is these things build for so long. And if you look at Red Bull, Formula One tends to go in cycles. They've had this amazing run of success. Now some people are leaving. They've got a little bit of destabilization, less consistency, a little bit of turmoil, and it can often lead you down a path where you stop humming along and things start to deteriorate inside and you have to go through another sort of period of rebuilding like McLaren did in the background. So then again, the numbers are pretty spectacular because it looks like a very clear line in the sand where McLaren were terrible and then they were great. But actually, it's a much longer process, much of it just done in the shadows, that then starts to eventually deliver the results. And the whole team is now really humming along and benefiting from all of that work that's happened over a long period of time.
Jake, let's have a look at the qualifying head-to-heads. I know it's something you look at quite closely. We've just been talking a lot there about McLaren. It's 3-3 in qualifying, so it's pretty evenly matched between Piastri and Norris. Piastri, part of the reason he's being successful is he's getting himself on the front row of the grid more often than Norris is. But it's 5-1 to Russell. Now, is that what you would have expected, given that Antonelli is a rookie? Has he done well to do the one? And of course, we should also remember that he got that stunning pole position in the sprint race, which is he's becomes the youngest driver ever to get any kind of Formula One pole position with that at just 18 years of age. But back to the actual Grand Prix themselves, 5-1 to Russell. Is that pretty much what you expected?
I think so. I think, as you said, I think maybe Antonelli lucky to get the one. When you come into Formula One at such a young age, yes, with quite a lot of hype, but ultimately having to come in and learn basically what F1 is, how to kind of deal with all of the increased media pressure, how to deal with everything else, having just done a season of Formula 2, having been in, you know, what, Italian F4, what, 3-4 years ago, it's a lot to take in. And I don't think people realize how much of a sea change it is for these young drivers coming in. Suddenly, you know, you're within 2 or 3 years, you've gone from racing a car that's 300, 400 brake horsepower to one that's pushing over 1,000. So it's just testament to the talent that Antonelli has, that not only has he been close to Russell in pretty much every race bar Melbourne, where he had that off at turn six, damaged his floor and got knocked out in Q1. Miami was just kind of the culmination of everything so far in this first quarter of the season. He's shown brilliant pace on occasion. It's not been consistent pace at the moment, and nor would you expect it to be so. But he's just been able to build and build and build through the weekends, getting that car in a place where it was good enough for the sprint pole in Miami. That was pretty impressive. I was genuinely, you know, I think watching F1 for what, the best part of 25 plus years, I think I wouldn't say jaded is the right word, but you feel like you've seen quite a few things before, but I was genuinely impressed by that.
I'm with you on that, Jake. I mean, I've been watching for probably twice that long and been in it for 35. And I have to tell you that that's right up there amongst the most impressive and feel good performances I've seen in all those years. It was, you could, and the best bit about it for me is you could see it coming from right at the beginning of sprint qualifying one. He was there from the beginning. He was on it, and he just built and built and built. And I love the inevitability of that. You know, for a Grand Prix driver to become inevitable is really, really difficult. And there was inevitability about that pole. And it's a bit like Piastri. You knew that Piastri was going to overtake Verstappen in the Grand Prix, but you didn't know, it wasn't inevitable that Norris was going to be able to overtake him without it getting messy. And that's what, you know, for me, when you get to that point of inevitability, you're into something very special. So anyway, I interrupted you and I'm sorry, but for that's what I loved about that Antonelli moment.
Yeah, I think it's just a testament to how much of a talent he is. I think it was kind of sort of forecast for quite a while. But yeah, to come in Formula One, race six, have some sense of superiority over Russell. And I know that we can go into the whys and wherefores and Russell struggling with front tire grip and not being able to bring the tires in over the Miami weekend. But Antonelli could. That's the bottom line. He was able to do something his teammate couldn't do. And I think we'll just, that was like a few things we saw from Piastri in his first year. I think he'll grow and grow, to be honest.
Another head-to-head, Mark, I want to just look at, because it's sort of quite newsworthy as well, looking back at the aftermath of Miami, is Pierre Gasly 5-1 against Jack Doohan, who has now, to no one's enormous surprise, been dropped by the Alpine team for five races, not permanently, apparently, but just for five races as they give Franco Colapinto a chance. Let's not get into all the details of the whys and the wherefores of all of that, but 5-1 Gasly. And I think what that really speaks to in terms of the decision is the fact that it's so tight. The difference between sixth in the constructors and ninth is literally having a second car that's going to score some points.
Yeah, that's right. You know, so on one hand, you can sort of understand when a team, any team, is in a situation like that where there's a massive disparity between one side of the garage and the other, you have to start considering at least what options you've got in terms of trying to fix that. One option might be to try and find a way to it, to elevate that driver, to give him something that he needs, whether that's adapting the car or looking through data and numbers to try and find solutions. And the other is clearly to swap that driver out. And they had that option. They've taken the option up. Only time really will tell. Brutal though it seems, and we've seen this already after just two races with Liam Lawson at Red Bull, but the answer will only come once we've had a few races play out and we see whether that's actually made the difference for Alpine as a team and brought them up the standings, scoring points. As we know, that's really important when it comes to the financials, particularly for, you know, for the years that follow. So it's not a trivial decision. It's not an easy decision. And it looks so harsh on a human level whenever these kind of things happen. But I do always have an element of understanding for the team situation, because you can't just allow this to go on. Unfortunately, modern Formula One doesn't give you the opportunity to put a driver on track every single week in between races and go testing to try and figure out solutions. You can do something in the virtual world, and it's all very clever and advanced now, and there's some really amazing tools to help you in that regard. But back in my day, and when you were first doing this, James, you'd have Jack Doohan in a test car on all of these tracks pretty much every single week till you figured it out. We don't have that chance anymore, so the team have taken this option to bring somebody else in, somebody who has at least some kind of proven record, albeit a fairly short one, and it's at Williams. And everything I said earlier on about the nuances of one car not necessarily matching the driving style of somebody else, we still don't really know whether Franco Colapinto will be able to repeat the form that we saw early on in his Williams career in an Alpine, but the team have taken the decision they've got to at least try.
A couple of other heads-to-heads from qualifying to look at quickly, Jake. Hadjar to Lawson, obviously there was some turnover there at Racing Bulls with Tsunoda at the start of the season. But if you're just looking at the Hadjar to Lawson comparison, it's 3-1 for Hadjar. And also over at Williams, Albon started very strongly. He's been going strongly in the races. Williams are in form of their recent years, to be honest, in terms of point scoring. But it's now 3-3 in qualifying, Albon and Sainz. Give us your read on those two situations.
This is sort of plays in quite nicely into the listing of super times I have here, because for a few seasons now, we've been kind of thinking, where's that fifth team going to come from? When it became apparent that Aston Martin wasn't going to close the gap between the front four and the rest of the field, it sort of very much felt like, where are these other teams going to come from? Williams and Racing Bulls have filled that position now. They're both just under 0.8% behind the theoretical fastest time, so they drop in nicely into those fifth and sixth places. I'll begin with the Williams duo, and I think ultimately this has been sort of quite testing for Carlos Sainz in that it's a car that he's unfamiliar with. I think the effect of actually switching to a different powertrain for the first time, that's thrown him a little bit, as it has done for Hamilton as well. They've both drivers have kind of spoken about that adaptation, given they've sort of been racing for so long with their respective, you know, with Sainz and a Ferrari, but using a Ferrari powertrain, Hamilton using the Mercedes, having to get used to the different inputs required to get the engine braking right, get the sort of acceleration right, that sort of thing. But ultimately, I think Albon has also been really, really impressive this season. I think he's been one of the standouts, and I think he has been one of the standouts for the last three seasons, actually. I sort of think that has sort of also semi-influenced Alpine's decision, because we know how good Sainz is. We now know how good Albon is. And I think by association, you sort of have a read of how theoretically good Colapinto can be. Anyway, that's a sort of slight tangent there. But Yeah, so Williams, yeah, science has been impressive, but Albon has just been, sort of carried the torch so far this season, that he's still eighth in the Drivers' Championship. On overall pace, out of all the drivers, he's also been the eighth fastest this season, ahead of both Tsunoda and Sainz. At RB, the story is slightly different. Hadjar has come into Formula One, and I'll be honest, he's really impressed me. I genuinely didn't have particularly high expectations of him coming in. You know, sort of being a second-year Formula 2 driver and finishing second takes the luster off a little bit. He'd sort of had the radio meltdowns in that series. He'd not had a particularly good, not particularly stellar time in Formula 3 anyway. But he's come in Formula 1. He's just shown some really good pace. Qualifying probably for him better than the races, but he's also shown Lawson the way since Lawson's come back into the team. I'm sort of waiting for that big result to happen, waiting for that sort of Liam's back and he's sort of recovered. We just haven't had that yet. Maybe the Miami sprint was going to be that, but he then crashed into Fernando Alonso. So that's out. And he just hasn't really kicked on, and maybe it'll take a couple more races for him to sort of feel a little bit more comfortable, but he does need to start scoring points soon, because as I say, Racing Bulls on pace, sixth fastest car this season, team is just not making the most of it at the moment.
You're listening to the James Allen and F1 podcast, part of the Autosport Podcast Network. For the latest from our reporters at the track during F1 weekends, head to the Autosport F1 channel.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Well, I'm delighted to say we're now joined by Formula One data guru and top engineer, formerly with Ferrari and Williams, Rob Smedley. Rob, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys. Morning.
Good morning. So we've been crunching the numbers on the first quarter season of Formula One, and we had got as far as talking about Mercedes, who were 0.4 seconds off McLaren at the start of the year. But over the last two rounds, it's been more like 0.2 in Saudi and 0.4 in Miami in terms of underlying car pace. They seem to have improved the car quite a bit, as witnessed by, obviously, Antonelli's stunning performance. Rob, what have you made of Mercedes? And earlier on, Jake was telling us that he thinks maybe Russell's an outside bet as a championship contender through to the end. How do you read it?
I mean, that would be, pretty strong, wouldn't it, if George became a championship contender by the end of the season. I mean, we're only like a quarter of the way through the season, right? So it's not beyond the realms of possibility that that could happen. Certainly when you look at the car, it seems to, you know, if you just observe it, as I was doing live at the weekend in Miami, on track, it seems to be a much easier car to handle than the last few versions of a Mercedes. And you're right, when you look at, like, statistically what they are doing in terms of development as well, we know that some of it is just natural ebb and flow of the tracks, but some of it is specific parts and packages that they're bringing that is definitely helping the car to work. Now, whether or not George can become a contender for the championship by the end of the season, certainly that's mathematically possible. And if they continue to develop the car at the rate that they are developing it, they could end up being able to catch McLaren. But I would say at this stage of the season, you know, the gap is big enough, and McLaren have a comfortable enough lead that they probably won't be troubling them by come the end of the season.
It's certainly encouraging for Mercedes that they sort of seem to be back in the game. And it, given that the rumours around are that they've got a very good powertrain for the new rules in 2026, I'm sure there's one or two drivers, including some quite successful drivers in other teams at the moment, who would be eyeing up Mercedes and thinking about them for the future. Russell then, in more numbers, 4 podiums so far, the only driver to finish in the top 5 at every race this season. Antonelli, the youngest driver ever to take pole in any F1 format at 18 years old, and the youngest to lead a lap as well. He's had 5 points finishes. So Mercedes looking pretty decent. Ferrari then, Rob, your old team. Hamilton's sprint win in China, the first win for a driver over the age of 40 in any race format since Nigel Mansell won the 1994 Australian Grand Prix, just proving that life still continues after 40 as a Grand Prix driver. Ferrari are the fastest in the pit lane this season with a 2-second pit stop. But the number that really says everything for me, Rob, is that they trailed McLaren by 14 points at the end of last year's Constructors' Championship. And with only a quarter of this season gone, they already trail them by 152 points.
Yeah. So let's call that 10 times a bigger deficit for a quarter away through the season. I mean, it tells you everything that you need to know about Ferrari's season so far, right? They are definitely not in the hunt for either of these championships. They pretty much stayed in the hunt for the Constructors' Championship from the start, having 2 very good drivers who continued to deliver points in what was either a very good or on occasion the best car. The season is very different for Ferrari as we see it now. Definitely with whatever they have done development over the winter period and with this year's car, you can see that they've dropped off. And again, it's always tiny amounts, right? We're not talking that there's been any huge swing, but it's a couple of tenths. If you take their relative position to McLaren last year you average that over the first quarter of the season, it's around about 2-3 tenths that they've dropped off. That's enough to put them in a much worse position. Qualifying remains difficult for them. Absolutely, qualifying is nowhere near as they're nowhere near as quick as they were last year. Race pace, they're kind of where they are in qualifying, and they seem to have at times they can get on top of the tyre management and tyre degradation, but it's just that the race pace just isn't quick enough. And then you see times like in Miami, when the two drivers were on slightly different strategies, could they have handled that slightly better live, real time? I think, like Fred said, Fred Vasseur come up with a comment after, this last weekend in Miami that, they'd taken a lap or two to decide to swap the two drivers, whether or not that would have made any difference and Lewis would have been able to catch Kimi Antonelli or not is kind of a little bit academic. So you see that, I'm not going to say that they're making mistakes with the strategy, because I think that's unfair. When you look at things on a Monday morning and analyze. But what I would say is that there are just because of the car pace and because of the difficulties that they're facing, there are bits of mistakes in how well they're executing just creep in. And that's pretty normal. That's pretty normal when you're under such pressure and you've taken on a 7 times world champion to help you kind of move everything to the next level. And in fact, it's been a difficult start to the season instead.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how they pull themselves out of this, isn't it? Jake, let's take a look at Aston Martin. A quarter of the season down, Stroll would you believe it, has scored all of Aston Martin's 14 points. Alonso yet to break his duck, even though it's 6-0 in qualifying to Alonso. Stroll has a fairly unwelcome record. He has the record for the most Q1 eliminations with 76. And next up is Magnussen with 74. In other words, he's been knocked out in Q1 76 times in his career. And the other one that made me smile, the other number from the Aston side of things, was Alonso. It's now 206 Grand Prix since his last race victory. And only 21 drivers in F1 history have actually started more races than that. Now, that just says more about the fact that, you know, obviously went away for a bit and did all sorts of other things and made a few poor choices. But they were really competitive at the beginning of last year. They're really uncompetitive at the beginning of this year. And I guess, Jake, you know, when you look at that, I think the surprising thing is that Stroll has actually delivered reasonably strongly in terms of the races, particularly when the conditions get a bit tricky.
Yeah, it's just, he just seems to be able to keep the car on the road, which I suppose we've maybe not said about him in other seasons. But Australia, for example, he was sort of doing his own thing. And then by the end of the race, he picked up a few places and finished sixth. Miami sprint race. I think the timing of the switch to slicks was quite fortuitous for him, and he ended up in fifth place. So it's for him, it's been relatively impressive in the way that he's sort of been able to accrue those points. When you look at Aston Martin as a whole, it's really, really clear that the car is quite poor. And they made a lot of changes over the off-season. You look at the car from an aerodynamic standpoint and it's very, very different. I think the internals are relatively similar to what they'd run last year. But clearly they've chased a few changes that just haven't worked out. And this is continuing a pattern of, and we saw this over 2024, the car started off in a good sort of vein of form, and they added some upgrades to it in Imola, made it a lot harder to drive. You saw Alonso all over the place during that weekend, and it just continued to snowball into falling off the pace. Now we're at a point where I think on pure pace terms, Aston Martin does have like the eighth fastest car, just a little bit ahead of Haas on a qualifying lap. The difference there is Haas is able to make the difference in the races. And it just seems to be just a leaner outfit. It just seems to be a little bit more well run. Aston Martin seems to be a little bit all over the place. And it just seems to be waiting for 2026 to happen, waiting for an Adrian Newey car to be delivered on its doorstep. It just seems like a holding pattern. I think I asked Fernando about this earlier this year. That it does seem like the case, and he's just like, yeah, that's the way it is, unfortunately. We're just waiting for the goods to come to us. So what that means for the rest of 2025, do you develop, do you not? There is some legitimate reason to develop. Equally, you don't want to lose your win time, you don't want to lose your budget, basically trying to get something out of a car that clearly is a little bit lacking on pace. You've got to work out where to sacrifice things. And ultimately, it does seem that they're going to put a pin in 2025 early, if they haven't done so already, and focus on, you know, starting a new, hopefully prosperous relationship with Adrian Newey. But ultimately, the team is just sort of a little bit at sea at the moment. And I don't really see where that turnaround is going to come from in the next year or so.
Interesting. Let's just shift gears slightly and take a look at the Pirelli tyre performance, because one of the things that perhaps people don't see quite so clearly when they watch the racing on the TV, they see human beings, they see they hear the radio messages, they follow all of the stories, but when you're talking about performance and success, it's actually a lot of it is, particularly with McLaren at the moment, is the way that they are managing those Pirelli tires. And we've got some numbers here with the support of Pirelli. This isn't confidential information. It's publicly available if you know how to find it. But Rob, when we look at the numbers from the point of view of the way all the teams, let's compare them all together. For example, when they're all, the most commonly used race tire is the C2 Pirelli, which has typically been used at most of the races this year. And it's certainly been the race tire that's been that's been used the most. What do you see?
So when you look at the C2, I mean, this is for me is the probably the most interesting element of the season so far. And I think we saw this from right from the get-go in Australia, that McLaren is able to keep its rear tyre temperatures under control. And it is exactly that, because when you look at the telemetry, or even when you look at the onboard cameras over a time lap when in qualifying over the softer tyres, in Australia, McLaren were able to be dominant in the third sector. That is a classic area for struggling with rear tyres that have overheated over the lap. And then it was dominant in the race. Given that, in China, it flipped around, because in China it was cooler. It's more of an understeer circuit. It's not a place where, at the end of the lap, where you're really struggling a lot with rear tyre temperatures. And you saw that the Ferrari and the Red Bull were able to be stronger relative to where they were in Australia. And then it's just gone on from there. You know, a little bit cooler track in Miami. And we saw Max take what was quite a magnificent pole, in fact. And most of that was done in the first sector, or in the first part of the lap, where he was able to extend quite a lead. And, you know, again, get to, you know, just as the flip side of overheating the tyres towards the end of the lap is usually cars that do that, they will put a lot of tyre temperature in at the start of the lap. And that's where, if there's any weakness in McLaren, it's in qualifying on a cooler track, and especially at the start of the lap on front tyres when they're trying to get temperature in. So this has been a really interesting balance over one timed lap since the start of the season. And you see that, you know, like, again, going back to Miami, drivers like Max are able to kind of transcend the car and put in a really good lap. But then when it comes to the race, and if we concentrate, like you said, James, on the C2 tyre, because that has been used more predominantly this season, it's all McLaren, because they're just able to affect less degradation. And again, it's not big numbers, right? So if you look at all of that data that you quite rightly say is available, the average of that of the C2 degradation when it's been used this season is 0.05 seconds per lap. So that means that every single lap, the tyre degrades by 0.05 seconds. So over 10 laps, it would be half a second slower than it was on the first lap. McLaren are just slightly less than that on average. So they're around about 0.04 seconds per lap. Whereas if you look at Red Bull, they're slightly more than that. You know, they're about 0.06 seconds per lap. And that tiny margin, this is what I absolutely love about Formula One. Those tiny margins of tyre degradation, tyre overheating, the way that these cars and driver combinations are using the tyres, you know, that ladders up to be like 3/4 tenths at the end of the stint. And 3/4 tenths at the end of the stint, when you add all that up over a race, comes to devastating effect of what McLaren can do. But again, I thought it was a really good, you know, I'm really glad that we can talk about this on the podcast, because I think it's really like a point of education for F1 fans in general about the tiny margins that we're talking about. You know, the average degradation is 0.05 seconds per lap. McLaren are probably about 80% of that. Red Bull are about 120% of that, 110% of that. But it's enough to make a massive difference in the race.
Especially when it's as close as it is at the moment. Jake, how do you read all this?
I think the interesting part of that is you can kind of see, again, as Rob has kind of already said, this difference between McLaren and the other front-running teams. I think of the data that we can see as well, it's also interesting to see how it changes from circuit to circuit when the C2 is employed as the medium tyre, for example, when we're having to move to that sort of harder suite of compounds. Then there's kind of a difference when it comes to, you know, surface roughness and heat and various other things as well. How that just how that affects the cars as well. So let's say, for example, Williams, when the C2 is the harder option, it seems to be sort of there or thereabouts with everybody, maybe sort of a little bit higher, but not overwhelmingly so. But then when we get to a point where the C2 is the softer grade of compound, when it is the medium, it does seem to struggle a little bit more with tire degradation. But actually, having run kind of my own numbers over the Miami weekend, which hasn't been included in this data, but when you look at that car, and this sort of jumps back to our point about Ferrari as well, actually that pace with the Williams looks super repeatable. Like the overall distribution of lap times between for Albon and Sainz, so much sort of narrower compared to the two Ferraris. Now, obviously, I'm sure there's kind of a little bit of their back and forth and swapping and not really knowing necessarily what to do with the strategy there. But it just seems to be actually quite a settled car. I think probably we can see from this data that the biggest bugbear of it is the tire deg, but at the same time, it seems to be a relatively, not necessarily a linear rate perhaps, but one that seems to be manageable for it. So it's quite interesting to sort of see this distribution. And even if a team does sort of have a measure of tire wear, it doesn't necessarily give it an advantage. It still has to have the underlying package as well to make the most of it.
Okay, well, thank you for that. That's very interesting. And I think we just close out with a couple of other numbers for some of the teams, perhaps a little bit further back on the grid. The two Haas drivers are top of the league in places gained in the race versus their grid position. I thought that was quite interesting. Ollie Bearman has made up 27 places from his grid slots so far this season in 6 rounds. And Esteban Ocon, his teammate, has made up 23. The next one is Stroll, who's in the teens. So what that says to me, Rob, is that the Haas is not, and you can see it as well in the underlying car pace, that the Haas is often around a second or more off the pace in terms of the actual single lap pace. But they do seem to be getting a tune out of it in the races.
Yeah, they do. And I think that it comes down to, I just wonder about that car in general. And you know, we probably should like look a little bit further into this. But I do wonder about how well they're able to look after their tyres as well. The degradation doesn't always tell us the full story, because I think, as Jake was saying, you've got to look at the underlying car pace as well. It's car pace, you know. So what is the pace, and then what degradation do you have? Because you'll quite often find that degradation can appear low, like the degradation number can appear low, because the drivers affect the slower pace to keep the degradation low. So they give up something at the start of the stint to get, you know, a better pace towards the end of the stint. Certainly with Haas, they do seem to be able to affect a half-decent pace at times. It's not in all of the tracks, but there are, you know, correlation with when you have a track where definite overheating is going on, or degradation in general, the Haas is able to do a better job. And I don't think, you know, some of that will be down to, let's say, Esteban Ocon's experience, but it can't all be down to experience, because you've got a rookie in the car as well. And, you know, one thing that you Formula One teams will always struggle with rookies compared to their more experienced counterparts is race pace, is how to handle the tyres, how to drive the car and keep it consistent, you know, within that 20, 30 millisecond time window every single lap, how not to overheat the tyres, how not to get too much degradation throughout a stint. So I think that if Ollie Bearman, who is a very, very talented driver, but is admittedly very inexperienced, is able to get good pace out of the Haas, there's probably something, you know, really good underlying going on there as well. They do, however, have to improve their qualifying pace, right? If they're going to ever have any chance of actually scoring any decent points during this year, they do have to improve their qualifying pace, which you know, leaves a lot to be desired on most occasions.
Yeah, it's not very sustainable to have to make up 27 places in 6 rounds, because not apart from anything else, you're having to take some risks in order to do that. So I think, again, it's credit to Bearman. He's not had the smoothest ride, but credit to him that he's been able to do that as a rookie. And it does speak a lot to his racecraft as well, I think, not as well as well as everything else. Well, listen, we could go on forever with the numbers. It's been very, very interesting. We're at the quarter stage of this championship. We'll do this again at the half stage, and we'll dig down into the numbers. But for now, my thanks to Rob, to Mark, and to Jake. Please do check out Jake's F1 writing and videos on Autosport and Motorsport, and Mark's podcast, Pit Lane Life Lessons. Have you been on that yet, Rob?
I have. Yes, I give him some good advice about how to bring up kids, because I'm obviously the world's like best parent. Tongue in cheek, never there.
Very good. Well, make sure you check that one out, and do join our fast growing fantasy league community. Check out motorsport.com for details, or it's in the episode description notes here. Remember to send in your comments and questions to @JamesAllenOnF1 on X. My thanks to Dre on production, and thanks to you for listening. Please click to follow or subscribe, leave us a review and a rating, and tell all your F1 mad friends about us. We'll be back with another podcast very soon.
You've been listening to the James Allen and F1 podcast, part of the Autosport Podcast Network. For the latest from our reporters at the racetrack during F1 weekends, check out the Autosport Podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.